Morning. So, Marty's not here, but he's supposed to be listening in, and it doesn't look like he is. Okay. Okay. So sorry. He'll call back, I guess. So, we're in lesson 6 of Job. I have the lessons up here. We're going to do all of lesson 6. Some of the lessons are divided up between two classes, and lessons 6 and 7 are up here. You have 7 for the next two classes. I'm the extra teacher. It was going to be Mason, but Mason taught last segment, and I think he's teaching next segment as well, so he wanted someone to fill in. I taught Joe with Marty before. Well, I tried to teach Joe with Marty. I mean, Marty is on a graduate level. So these lessons are very deep. I'm grasping them as we go, and hopefully I'll be able to do them some bit of justice. So we have 7 chapters to go through today, and this is the second cycle of debates between Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. So they speak, Job speaks. It's like they're in conflict with each other. And so we'll begin by talking about some of these observations from the last class. Now, Marty sent this to me. Even though the Skype didn't really work, he wanted it to be more interactive. It ended up being a monologue. And so instead, he just got to get you to listen to him and he didn't hear your interactions with the class. First of all, in this first cycle of debates, there was a lot of quibbling, and when they said, "I know as much as you," and it almost sounds like you think you're so smart, you know, and that's, it was kind of like quibbling what you would think that the children would say to each other. And so, also, another observation, there were these differing interpretations of Eliphaz's vision about, like, at night when you ponder things, and one interpretation that I felt like I got from it was that every man, let's see, I think it was really kind of like jealousy, Job's wisdom, and that Job's wisdom was going to die with him. And so this interpretation was, you know, kind of different than maybe some, but this is what I got out of it anyway. Also, Job had this growing aggressiveness toward the friends and also toward God. And it started out kind of like, well, you know, they sat with him for 7 days and said not even a word for 7 days. And then they addressed him and he spoke back to them. And then now it's growing and getting more aggressive. And the reason for the aggressiveness, I think, is that, well, maybe there was some growing frustration on Job's part, and frustration on the friend's part. Also, some anger toward each other, and an impatience about what's going to happen next. And so, Job was getting more aggressive toward them because of what they were saying to him also. Job's trial conclusions, this is a variation on theology of retribution. There's lessons up here, lessons 6 and 7, if anyone needs them, you can wait till later. Also, the lessons are online in case you need them. So his conclusions about this theology of retribution, and he has a different way of saying it. It's a variation on this theology of retribution. He says that, well, in conclusion, just maybe God just punishes everybody, and God doesn't just punish those who are wicked. And he doesn't just reward those who are good. That he punishes everyone. And also, he allows those who are evil to be successful. So, and this is Job's conclusion, his little variation on this theology of retribution that we've been talking about. Also, there's this fundamental error, the friends. And this is a sub-theme of the book. And this is, we're observing from the last class of Marty had this, it was just he had to just speak, it was a regular monologue. So this fundamental error of these friends, that they were speaking for God, that they were putting themselves in God's place and telling Job what they think he needed to hear in God's shoes. But don't we sometimes do that? Isn't that sometimes what we decide to do when we see someone who's struggling or see someone who is doing something we feel that they should be doing different? Don't we put ourselves in God's shoes and say something to them? So this was the error that the friends had. It's the sub-theme of this book. Also, Job's concept of death, and we're going to talk more about his concept of death. And to Job, death was the end, and it was darkness and sleep, some kind of unconsciousness. He didn't have this whole picture of heaven like we do. And so therefore, there are some closed doors I would like to talk to you about as well. But then he had this wish. He wished that he could die and then come back somehow to a restored relationship with God. And this really talks about his fear. Job's fear was that this relationship was somehow severed, that he no longer had the relationship he once had with God. And so, let's talk about these closed doors for just a moment. One door that we're going to close, and this is not an escape hatch. We can't say this, even though maybe we are tempted to. We can just sit back and say, oh, Satan did this. This was all Satan's doing. But Satan is limited. Satan couldn't do it unless God allowed him to do these things to Job. Twice he came to God and said, let me take away everything. Let me do everything, even make him suffer, but don't kill him. But God allowed that. God didn't have to allow that. So we can't really just say that Satan did it. 2 Corinthians 12:7, thorn in the flesh. Okay. Another door that's closed is that we can't just say that, oops, we can't just say that every man sins and deserves God's wrath, because we see in the very beginning that this is not because of Job's sin. Maybe he sins later when he criticizes and challenges God. But he didn't get this. He didn't receive this suffering and all this calamity because of his sin. Okay, so we can't really open that door and say that this is because of Job's sin. Okay, another door that's closed is that, well, Job was just being perfected. Okay, James chapter 5 and 11 refers to this particular book of Job and what he was doing, that he had such great patience. And we really can't say that the purpose of this was for Job, so he could be perfected. First couple of verses in Job says that he was what? He was perfect. Okay, he was perfect, okay? Another closed doors, we can't say that, well, just heaven is the answer to all of this. Because we see here that Job didn't really have an accurate picture of heaven. He didn't have the inspired word like we do. Okay, he didn't know about heaven and what it was like. He thought that it was the end, it was darkness, unconsciousness, sleep. He didn't have this picture of heaven. And then the last door that's closed is we can't talk about, well, this is just the probability and statistics of calamity, that every once in a while people are going to suffer. Well, no, because we know that God was involved in allowing him to be the one who suffers this calamity. So we can't say that God just does what is right and fair most of the time, but there are some exceptions. Ecclesiastes 9:11 kind of addresses that as well. So these are our closed doors. We're not going to go down those roads. We're going to limit our questions to basically three here. That one of the statements I'm about to show you must be false. Must be false. One of the three statements, okay? So, in our schedule here, and Marty kind of blows by this, and I don't blame him, to see that I was teaching three times before, but now that we have a new schedule, Philip Mullins is going to visit and have a gospel meeting the 8th and 11th of October. It was originally just the 8th, but we've extended it some time. So now we have one extra meeting on Sunday, the 29th of October, which we'll have our application and review. And Marty is bringing up some kind of a final exam that he's going to give, and we can post those results and let everyone see how we did. Okay. So, but you're stuck with me for two more sessions after the meeting. Marty will begin lesson 7, and I'll complete lesson 7, and we'll speak about Elihu's speech as the younger, less wise Elihu. Okay, and then we're getting close. We're going to be talking about at least 7 of these chapters today, if we can make it through. So here we are, the second cycle of debates. We've been through the first cycle with the Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. And we're going to do another cycle of debates today. We're going to talk about, and things are getting more argumentative, and there's more frustration, and more accusations that come out. And so this is where we are in the structure of Job. So let's look at these 3 questions now. Well, before we look at the 3 questions, we have these objections to talk about. So, first objective, we have to be able to try to explain how Job's friends find this specific proof of his sin in verses 5 and 6 of chapter 15. We're starting in chapter 15 today. So, Eliphaz comes right out of the gate telling Job about specific proof that he has of his sin. And we should be able to list some examples from Job's speeches in which he appears to answer specific points of the friends. There's a parallel in what the friends, the so-called friends, say and what Job responds with. And so you'll see those parallels. And then finally, we should be able to explain how the friends modify this theology of retribution to explain why the wicked prosper. And that's briefly, if we should be able to do that. Okay, the three statements. And one of these 3 statements, we should be able to determine that it's not true, but we haven't gotten to that point yet. Either God is just and righteous. Well, we all believe that, right? And God is all-powerful. I think we all believe that. Or that Job is righteous. And it says he is, so maybe he's not. So one of these 3 statements can't work if we keep all those doors closed that we talked about before. So one of those 3 statements, based on the way this book is set up and the way the facts and everything happened, one of them just can't be true. So we have to work through this and come up with a conclusion about which one of these particular statements is not true. Okay. All right. Is everybody with me? And any questions so far? Okay. Very good. All right. Let's go ahead and do a little bit more review of this first cycle. And something happens here with Eliphaz later on in Job. In chapter 42, we get this statement where God says, "After the Lord had said these things to Job, he said to Eliphaz the Temanite, 'I'm angry with you and your 2 friends because you have not spoken the truth about me, as my servant Job has.'" So that's kind of going to the end to look back now. And well, Eliphaz and his 2 friends, they weren't being truthful about God to Job, but Job was. Okay. All right. Let's review a little bit more of the first cycle before we go a little bit further. So, and maybe these were defensive positions of Job, but he kind of goes on the offensive also here. So first of all, he maintains his innocence. Chapter 6 and verse 10. He says he's not denied the words of the Holy One. Also chapter 6 and verse 24. He says, "Show me where I have been wrong." Okay, so maybe that's defense, but I think he's going on the offense here too. And then he has this kind of way that he talks about the anti-theology of retribution, where he says in verse 21 of chapter 9, he says, "I am blameless." And then also in chapter 8 and verse 20, he says, "God doesn't reject the blameless." So it's kind of an anti-theology of retribution there. And then chapter 10 and verse 3, he accuses his friends. He says that you are smiling on the plans of the wicked in what you're doing here. Smiling on the plans of the wicked. Also, he insults them. He accuses them of being like the intermittent streams, the wadis that they have in the Middle East, that are here one day and then gone the next day. These wadis, they're undependable his friends are not dependable. They're undependable as these waddies in chapter 6 and verse 15. Also in chapter 12 and verse 2, he accuses them of thinking that they're the only people that matter, that no one else matters except for their opinions and what they think. And then chapter 13 and verse 4, he says they're like worthless physicians. You ever been to a doctor and they just kind of prescribe some stuff and then you go home and nothing happens? Your symptoms stay the same? Well, he's accusing them of being like these worthless physicians. And then he challenges God here in chapter 7 and verse 17 by saying, "What is man that you make so much of him, that you give him so much attention?" So this is an accusation he levies toward God about this. And so he goes on the offensive to his friends, and he starts to go on the offensive also to directly to God. Okay. Any questions or comments before we continue? Because we're about to enter into the seven chapters, and we're going to go forward with this pretty quickly. It's already 15 minutes. We only have a little bit more than 30 minutes. Seven chapters in 30 minutes, that's a very tall order. And we'll just go forward, unless you have any comments or questions. Okay, I don't have a Bible NIV, but I printed one, so I'd rather hold a Bible, but this is the NIV, just so you know that, okay? Because we're using the NIV just specifically for this class. So we'll begin in verse 1 of chapter 15, where Eliphaz the Temanite responds. Eliphaz the Temanite, we'll read 1 through 6 to begin with. "Would a wise person answer with empty notions or fill their belly with the hot east wind? Would they argue with useless words, with speeches that have no value? But you even undermine piety and hinder devotion to God." Now here's the evidence in verses 5 and 6. "Your sin prompts your mouth. You adopt the tongue of the crafty. Your own mouth condemns you, not mine. Your own lips testify against you." So we have a little matching here going on. So which one would this be out of the ones? 5. Okay, so this really, your words are evidence of sinfulness against God. And that's the evidence that Eliphaz offers here, that Job is sinful because of the way he's handling himself with what he says. That's evidence of his craftiness, evidence of his that he's being condemned, that the sin comes from his mouth, and that's the evidence. Okay, verse 7. "Are you the first man ever born? Were you brought forth before the hills? Do you listen in on God's counsel? Do you have a monopoly on wisdom? What do you know that we do not know?" He's saying, "Oh, you think you're so smart." Okay, it's kind of a childish way for him to act here. "But what insights do you have that we do not have? The gray-haired and the aged are on our side, men even older than your father. Are God's consolations not enough for you? Words spoken gently to you? Why has your heart carried you away, and why do your eyes flash so that you vent your rage against God and pour out such words from your mouth? What are mortals that they could be pure, or those born of woman that they could be righteous? If God places no trust in his holy ones, if even the heavens are not pure in his eyes, how much less mortals who are vile and corrupt, who drink up evil like water?" Now you can see things are getting ramped up here. The first set of debates, Eliphaz was a little more tender. This time he says, "I've got evidence of your sin, and this is the way things are." And I mean, they sat there for 7 days, and now things are ramping up. They're getting frustrated, impatient, angry. Okay, so which one would this be? Which are matching here? Number 2. Very good. Okay, so are you wiser than all men, even the oldest, to rage against God? So, okay. All right, continuing in verse 17. "Listen to me, and I will explain to you. Let me tell you what I have seen, what the wise have declared, hiding nothing received from their ancestors, to whom alone the land was given, when no foreigners moved among them. All his days the wicked man suffers torment, the ruthless man through all the years stored up for him. Terrifying sounds fill his ears. When all seem well, marauders attack him. He despairs of escaping the realm of darkness. He is marked for the sword. He wanders about for food like a vulture. He knows the day of darkness is at hand. Distress and anguish fill him with terror. Troubles overwhelm him like a king poised to attack. Because he shakes his fist at God and vaunts himself against the Almighty, defiantly charging against him with a thick, strong shield. Though his face is covered with fat and his waist bulges with flesh, he will inhabit ruined towns and houses where no one lives, houses crumbling to rubble. He will no longer be rich, and his wealth will not endure, nor will his possessions spread over the land. He will not escape the darkness. A flame will wither his shoots, and the breath of God's mouth will carry him away. Let him not deceive himself by trusting what is worthless, for he will get nothing in return. Before his time, he will wither, and his branches will not flourish. He will be like a vine stripped of its unripe grapes, like an olive tree shedding its blossoms. For the company of the godless will be barren, and fire will consume the tents of those who love bribes. They conceive trouble and give birth to evil. Their womb fashions deceit. Very high accusations are being thrown now at Job, that he is this man that Eliphaz is talking about. Which one are we talking about here?
Three or nine?
Well, good guess, nine. I've learned that the wicked, because of his defiance, suffers greatly. Another pounding on this theology of retribution, a little bit varied from the theology of retribution, but another way to look at it. Okay, chapter 16. Then Job replied, "I have heard many things like these. You are miserable comforters, all of you. Will your long-winded speeches never end? What ails you that you keep on arguing? I also could speak like you if you were in my place. I could make fine speeches against you and shake my head at you. But my mouth would encourage you. Comfort from my lips would bring you relief." So what's Job saying here? He says, the tables were turned. I wouldn't be as mean as you guys are. I would be much more consoling. Okay. So which one are we talking about? Which number? Number one. Okay. I've learned that the wicked, because of his defiance, suffers greatly. One. Poor comforters you are. If I were in your place, I would actually be a comforter, but they're not being comforting at all. So, beginning in verse 6, Job continues and says, "Yet if I speak, my pain is not relieved. And if I refrain, it does not go away. Surely, God, you have worn me out. You have devastated my entire household. You have shriveled me up, and it has become a witness. My gauntness rises up and testifies against me. God assails me and tears me in his anger and gnashes his teeth at me. My opponent fastens on me his piercing eyes. People open their mouths to jeer at me. They strike my cheek in scorn and unite together against me. God has turned me over to the ungodly and thrown me into the clutches of the wicked. All was well with me, but he shattered me. He seized me by the neck and crushed me. He has made me his target. His archers surround me. Without pity, he pierces my kidneys and spills my gall on the ground. Again and again, he bursts upon me. He rushes at me like a warrior. I have sewed sackcloth over my skin and buried my brow in the dust. My face is red with weeping. Dark shadows ring my eyes, yet my hands have been free of violence, and my prayer is pure." So he's defending himself, but he's kind of going on the offense to do this. He's telling them they're poor comforters. And then he's stating his plight. Which number is this one? In the matching? Four. Okay, very good. Four. God's destroyed me, and my friends have left me. That's his plight. Continuing in verse 18, earth, do not cover my blood. May my cry never be laid to rest. Even now my witness is in heaven. My advocate is on high. My intercessor is my friend. As my eyes pour out tears to God, on behalf of a man, he pleads with God as one pleads for a friend. This is separate from the others. It's obviously different. So, what is he saying here? Which number?
Seven.
Okay. Let my innocent blood and anguished cry be my intercessors before God. And then only two verses, the next two verses, beginning in 22. Only a few years will pass before I take the path of no return. My spirit is broken, my days cut short, the grave awaits me. He's ready to just do what? He's just ready to die. He's done. Okay? You ever get to the point in something where you're just done? I do. Sometimes you wish, oh, please let this be the time where I'm gone. Let it be over. Okay, so this is number 8. A few more years and the grave awaits me. Okay, beginning in verse 2 of chapter 17. Surely mockers surround me. My eyes must dwell on their hostility. Give me, O God, the pledge you demand. Who else will put up security for me? You have closed their minds to understanding. Therefore, you will not let them triumph. If anyone denounces their friends for reward, the eyes of their children will fail. Which one?
Three.
Okay. Promise God that these men will not triumph. So, Job is very frustrated at this point. He wants justice. Does he see justice? He doesn't. Okay. All right. Beginning in verse 6, God has made me a byword to everyone. That word byword. So, he is a byword. What does that mean? Think about a byword. It's almost like a common, you know, we even use him today as a byword when we say, oh, wow, that person really has it bad. They must be, you know, must really have the patience of Job. There's the byword again, okay? He's a byword. And so he recognizes that here, that people refer to him. Look how great it was for him, and now how low he's been brought. And that's a byword. A man in whose face people spit. My eyes have grown dim with grief. My whole frame is but a shadow. The upright are appalled at this. The innocent are aroused against the ungodly. Nevertheless, the righteous will hold their ways, and those with clean hands will grow stronger. But come on, all of you, try again. I will not find a wise man among you. My days have passed, my plans are shattered, yet the desires of my heart turn night into day. In the face of the darkness, light is near. If the only home I hope for is the grave, if I spread out my bed in the realm of darkness, if I say to corruption, you are my father, and to the worm, my mother or my sister, where then is my hope? Who can see any hope for me? Will it go down to the gates of death? Will we descend together in the dust? He's asking this question, really, what does this all mean? He wants to know. He wants wisdom. He wants knowledge. So this one is number 6. I'm the outcast surrounded by those who deny the obvious. I have no hope but death. So, that's his response in a couple of chapters to Eliphaz. And then Bildad. I always think about his name because my name is Bill, and I'm a dad, so, you know, Bill Dad. But this guy's really not like me. Bildad the Shuhite replied, when will you end these speeches? Be sensible, and then we can talk. Why are we regarded as cattle and considered stupid in your sight? You tear yourself to pieces in your anger. Is the earth to be abandoned for your sake, or must the rocks be removed be moved from their place. Now, Job is talking about God tearing him, but Bildad says, no, you're tearing yourself in your own anger. So which number is this one? Bildad now. This is number 3. Okay, very good. Calm down. Be sensible. Will you treat us as foolish men? Are we stupid? Again, you think you're so smart, right? I mean, it's almost like kids talking out in the playground. I can just hear them, you know. So, let's begin at verse 5 now. The lamp of a wicked man is snuffed out. The flame of his fire stops burning. The light of his tent becomes dark. The lamp beside him goes out. The vigor of his step is weakened. His own schemes throw him down. His feet thrust him into a net. He wanders into its mesh. A trap seizes him by the heel. A snare holds him fast. A noose is hidden for him on the ground. A trap lies in his path. Terrors startle him on every side and dog his every step. Calamity is hungry for him. Disaster is ready for him when he falls. It eats away parts of his skin. Death's firstborn devours his limbs. He is torn from the security of his tent and marched off to the king of terrors. Fire resides in his tent. Burning sulfur is scattered over his dwelling. His roots dry up below, and his branches wither above. The memory of him perishes from the earth. He has no name in the land. He is driven from light into the realm of darkness, and he is banished from the world. He has no offspring or descendants among his people, no survivor where once he lived. People of the West are appalled at his fate. Those of the East are seized with terror. Surely, such is the dwelling of an evil man. Such is the place of one who does not know God. What an accusation. Bildad is telling Job, you messed up somehow, and this has come back on you. You're suffering greatness because of your deeds. So, number 6 says, the fate of the wicked is certain and terrible, trapped, weakened, terrorized, and cut off with his descendants. Again, we have this theology of retribution. Okay? If you're evil, if you're wicked, you're going to suffer. And Bildad is putting that right in his face. And he continues. Well, no. Job finally replies. Okay? He listens to Bildad, and this is a little parallel here. Chapter 19 and verse 1, Job says, how long will you torment me and crush me with words? 10 times now you have reproached me. If it is true that I have gone astray, my error remains my concern alone. And if indeed you would exalt yourselves above me and use my humiliation against me, then know that God has wronged me and drawn his net around me. So, Job's defense here is that, no, it's not from my sin. God has decided to allow this calamity to come to me. And he's right, isn't he? God has decided that this is what's going to happen. Notice the parallel. He goes, how long are you going to torment me and crush me? And earlier on, I forget which one it was, they said, how long are you going to use your words and get puffed up with the east wind? So this is number 2, where he says, is there no break in your attacks against me? Is there no relief that we can get? Chapter 19 and verse 7, Job says, though I cry, violence, I get no response. Though I call for help, there's no justice. He has blocked my way so I cannot pass. He has shrouded my paths in darkness. He has stripped me of my honor and removed the crown from my head. He tears me down on every side till I am gone. He uproots my hope like a tree. His anger burns against me. He counts me among his enemies. His troops advance in force. They build a siege ramp against me and encamp around my tent. So, we talked about earlier this this hedge that God built to protect Job. Now, Job is talking about this now as not a hedge that protects him, but something that has him trapped. And he's no longer protected, but he's stuck in his punishment. So in verse 1, or in part 1, he says, though I complain, God has hemmed me in. That hedge has turned into a hem where he's trapped in his punishment. Continuing in verse 13 of chapter 19, Job says, he's alienated my family from me. My acquaintances are completely estranged from me. My relatives have gone away. My closest friends have forgotten me. My guests and my female servants count me a foreigner. They look on me as a stranger. I summon my servant, but he does not answer. Though I beg with him with my own mouth, my breath is offensive to my wife. Well, mine is too, but that's another story. I am loathsome to my own family. Even the little boys scorn me. When I appear, they ridicule me. All my intimate friends detest me. Those I love have turned against me. I am nothing but skin and bones. I have escaped only by the skin of my teeth. Have pity on me, my friends. Have pity, for the hand of God has struck me. Why do you pursue me as God does? Will you never get enough of my flesh? So you can see his frustration and anger and impatience has ramped things up here. Even my friends and family scorn me. And then in verse 23 he says, oh, that my words were recorded, that they were written on a scroll. They are, but he didn't know that at the time. That they were inscribed with an iron tool on lead, or engraved in rock forever. I know that my Redeemer lives, and that in the end he will stand on the earth. And after my skin has been destroyed, yet in my flesh I will see God. I myself will see him with my own eyes. I, and not another, how my heart yearns within me. So he wishes there was some way to record them, not knowing that it would be, and that after my death, that he would be vindicated, and that people would see that he was innocent, that he was being punished for no reason. Verse 28, if you say, how will we hound him? How we will hound him, since the root of the trouble lies in him. You should fear the sword yourselves, for wrath will bring punishment by the sword, and then you will know that there is judgment. And this is 7. They continue to accuse him. They were going to see that judgment for themselves. And then Zophar, the Naamathite, replied, my troubled thoughts prompt me to answer because I am greatly disturbed. I hear a rebuke that dishonors me, and my understanding inspires me to reply. Surely you know how it has been from old, ever since mankind was placed on the earth, that the mirth of the wicked is brief, accusing Job. The joy of the godless lasts but a moment. He's referring to Job again here. Though the pride of the godless person reaches to the heavens and his head touches the clouds, he will perish forever like his own dung. Those who have seen him will say, where is he? Like a dream, he flies away, no more to be found, banished like a vision of the night. The eye that saw him will not see him again. This place will look on him no more. His children must make amends to the poor. His own hands must give back his wealth. The youthful vigor that fills his bones will lie with him in the dust. Here we have number 4. In Job's and Zophar's accusations here, basically referring to Job telling him, you're wicked, and that's why you're being punished. Verse 12, Zophar continues, though evil is sweet in his mouth and he hides it under his tongue, though he cannot bear to let it go and lets it linger in his mouth, yet his food will turn sour in his stomach. It will become the venom of serpents within him. He will spit out the riches he swallowed. God will make his stomach vomit them up. He will suck the poison of serpents The fangs of an adder will kill him. He will not enjoy the streams, the rivers flowing with honey and cream. What he toiled for, he must give back, uneaten. He will not enjoy the profit from his trading, for he has opposed the poor and left them destitute. He has seized houses he did not build. Surely he will have no respite from his craving. He cannot save himself by his treasure. Is this really accurate about Job? It's not. Job did wonderful things for the destitute. And so this is being levied against him, saying that, well, since you're suffering, it must be because of all this stuff that happened. But no, that's not the way it happened. God keeps the wicked man from enjoying his ill-gotten pleasures. But Job's pleasures were not ill-gotten. Continuing in verse 21, Zophar says, nothing is left for him to devour. His prosperity will not endure. In the midst of his plenty, distress will overtake him. The full force of misery will come upon him. When he has filled his belly, God will vent his burning anger against him and rain down his blows on him. Though he flees from an iron weapon, a bronze-tipped arrow pierces him. He pulls it out of his back, the gleaming point out of his liver. Terrors will come over him. Total darkness lies in wait for his treasures. A fire unfanned will consume him and devour what is left in his tent. The heavens will expose his guilt. The earth will rise up against him. A flood will carry off his house, rushing waters on the day of God's wrath. Such is the fate God allots the wicked, the heritage appointed to them for them by God. And so Zophar is not holding back either at this time. He says, Job, you're getting what's coming to you. And you deserve this, and you've earned it by your sin. And so the terror and misery of God's punishment will be inescapable. And this is what Zophar ends with. Wow. I can't believe that already. Okay, seven chapters in one class is a little bit much. Maybe we didn't need to read every single bit of this, but I felt it was kind of necessary. Alright, last chapter, Job's final word in this second cycle of debates. And he replies, listen carefully to my words. Let this be the consolation you give me about listening. Bear with me while I speak, and after I have spoken, mock on. So listen first, and then you can mock me later. Is my complaint directed to a human being? Why should I not be impatient? Look at me and be appalled. Clap your hand over your mouth. When I think about this, I'm terrified. Trembling seizes my body. Why do the wicked live on, growing old and increasing in power? Questioning about this theology of retribution. The wicked should be prospering. Why is that happening? They see their children established around them, their offspring before their eyes. Their homes are safe and free from fear. The rod of God is not on them. Their bulls never fail to breed. Their cows calve and do not miscarry. They send forth their children as a flock. Their little ones dance about. They sing to the music of timbrel and lyre. They make merry to the sound of the pipe. They spend their years in prosperity and go down to the grave in peace. Yet, they say to God, leave us alone. We have no desire to know your ways. Who is the Almighty that we should serve him? What would we gain by praying to him? Flipped around, this theology of retribution. The evil saying, you don't need God. But their prosperity is not in their own hands, so I stand aloof from the plans of the wicked. Number three here. Hear me, look at me now. Now I think of the wicked who live in prosperity and peace while blaspheming God. It just doesn't make sense. Continuing in verse 17, yet how often is the lamp of the wicked snuffed out? How often does calamity come upon them? The fate of God allots in his anger. How often are they like straw before the wind, like chaff swept away by a gale? It is said, God stores up the punishment of the wicked for their children. Let him repay the wicked so that they themselves will experience it. Let their own eyes see their destruction. Let them drink the cup of wrath of the Almighty. For what do they care about the families they leave behind when their allotted months come to an end? Can anyone teach knowledge to God, since he judges even the highest? One person dies in full vigor, completely secure and at ease, well nourished in body, bones rich with marrow. Another dies in bitterness of soul, never having enjoyed anything good. Side by side they lie in dust, and worms cover them both. So here we have number 6. The wicked are punished, but how often? They seems to be no sense about who suffers and who doesn't. So he's saying basically that this theology of retribution really doesn't apply here, since the wicked prosper and the righteous have to suffer like he is. Okay, one final section here, and then we will have barely completed these 7 chapters. I know full well what you're thinking, the schemes by which you would wrong me. You say, where now is the house of the great, the tents where the wicked lived? Have you never questioned those who travel? Have you paid no regard to their accounts, that the wicked are spared from the day of calamity, that they are delivered from the day of wrath? Who denounces their conduct to their face? Who repays them for what they have done? They are carried to the grave, and watch is kept over their tombs. The soil in the valley is sweet to them. Everyone follows after them, and a countless throng goes before them. So how can you console me with your nonsense? Nothing is left of your answers but falsehoods. So he basically accuses them again. You're just a bunch of misfits. You're lying, and with your nonsense. So the last one left is this number 1. Okay, so if we have time, let's talk about some of these layers of unanswered questions, but we don't. So we'll leave that to next time. Okay. Thank you very much for your attention. Appreciate you bearing with me and enduring through the 7 chapters of readings and the matchings. But Marty will hopefully wrap this up in these layers of questions on Wednesday. Thank you very much.